You're listening to a History Hub podcast. History Hub is based at the School of History at University College Dublin. Subscribe to our podcasts on Apple, Spotify, and on SoundCloud. For more information and to listen to hundreds of podcasts, go to historyhub.ie. The annual Tudor and Stuart Ireland Interdisciplinary Conference welcomes established academics, early stage and independent researchers, as well as postgraduates from Ireland and beyond to present their research in a genuinely collegial environment. The conference takes place in a venue in Ireland in August every year, and for more information on attending, go to tudorstuartireland.com. The 12th annual Tudor and Stuart Ireland Interdisciplinary Conference took place in the University of Galway in August 2024. The conference was organised by Mary-Louise Coulihan, Maureen DeLeo, Andrew Levy, Brenda Louise, Millie Randall and Ian Wong, and generously supported by the Department of English at the University of Galway and Marsh's Library. As in previous years, the majority of papers were recorded for podcasting by Real Smart Media, in association with UCD's History Hub. There is now an extensive archive of around 300 podcasts from previous Tudor and Stuart Ireland conferences freely available to listen to. To access this archive, go to historyhub.ie or search for Tudor and Stuart Ireland on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud or on Spotify. In this episode, a recording of the opening plenary address, which is given by Sarah McKibben from Notre Dame. Her paper was entitled Courtly Seductions, Reading a Bardic Love Poem in the 21st Century.
Gurmagat Nessa, Andrew, agus egagushta, Marie-Louise, Iwona, agus gachdina, achar falterom, rish. Es even lam vere ashing aliv, chan pisaibre, nua, kian bagani nis eidzrema, agus priula, namars knar, arin to live. Thanks everyone so much for welcoming me back so kindly, and what a joy it is to be back in Galway. The university is much, much bigger than it used to be. It's really quite fabulous. And it's so lovely to be able to speak at my favorite conference that I can't usually attend, because usually our courses start about 4 days after the conference. And this year we've got a whole 10 days. So that's brilliant. All right. So across the profession and beyond it, we continue to feel the reverberations of the Me Too movement, which has caused reconsideration of policies and practices, names and norms. In turn, we have found that the way we read genres and individual texts may shift as we question prior assumptions. At the same time, in the varied fields of early modern studies, we find ourselves asking how to read texts and genres once thought settled, finding inspiration in approaches championed by emerging scholars, as well as in criticism from adjacent locations and fields. We may choose to ask, with whom do we align ourselves? What do we assume about author and audience? How do certain words and phrases reverberate afresh, given the changes in language and social norms since the original composition? What new and varied readings might be sparked by our sense of our moment and preoccupations, as well as our sense of the past, each of which continues to change? Might we also discern latent impulses in texts that we simply failed to discern or fully explore previously? Humor, as Maria Tomaszko demonstrated in relation to medieval Irish literature, is especially susceptible to transformation or even evaporation as tastes and contexts change. Yet, as I will show, even early modern texts may contain playful self-critique that resonates centuries later. Accordingly, this talk considers early modern Monaghan bardic poet Laoiseach Mac Award's Tuirseachtain a Mhaca of Mná, Weary It Is My Lady to See, arguing that this little seduction poem is deserving of attention as more complex and more timely than one might think, which I will attempt to show by close attention to the text's rhetorical moves, in part through referencing the unconventional comparanda of the contemporary pickup artist discourse. That close reading will take up the bulk of this essay, of this talk, before a brief concluding consideration of some contemporaneous texts contemporaneous with it, an anonymous love poem in a woman's voice, thought to date to the same era, and another short love poem by the same poet, both given on your handout. I will attempt thereby to persuade you that this poem is a little gem of the Irish genre of courtly or learned love poetry, and a late undoing of the genre toward parodic and or even proto-feminist ends, and thus that it demonstrates the subtlety, wit, and sophistication of the bardic tradition and the persistent value of close reading. Today's poem, number 11 in O'Rahilly's canonical 1926 anthology of 106 Dents de Gras, is known from one 17th century manuscript and four 18th century ones, at least according to the Bardic database. So there may be some more. The handout gives the full text, 11 stanzas in the meter of Ranyacht War, some of the ornamentation lacking, along with an artistic translation by the Earl of Longford, Edward Pakenham, that captures the spirit of things, while I myself will offer more literal translations as I proceed through the text. The poem's author, born into a prominent hereditary northern bardic family, is known to have flourished in the late 1590s and early 1600s. The poem I explore is one of five extant poems attributed to Leeshach Mac Award. In addition to this one, these include a six-stanza punning love poem that I will reference subsequently, a brutally lacerating satire attacking the manhood of an anglicized young man that I have discussed at length elsewhere, a religious poem, and a poem lamenting the deliberate settler colonial destruction of an ancient tree, recently adroitly analyzed by Pat Palmer and featured in the Galway City Museum's current exhibit on the Gaelic learned classes. As this audience knows well, bardic poets like this poet traditionally focused on the production of encomiastic, religious, didactic, genealogical, or historical narrative verse of ornate metrical complexity and of prodigious length, often running 30 to 50 stanzas or more. Though no long praise poems by this particular Mac Award poet have survived, possibly owing to the vagaries of transmission, but equally possibly signaling the poet's inability to secure a lordly patron, whether due to the unsettled times or his alarming facility with satire. At any rate, as we know, praise poetry was the most extensive and expensive subgenre of the professional poetry that was composed for nearly five centuries by highly trained male literati to be declaimed, chanted, or sung at gatherings such as feasts by trained reciters in return for substantial ongoing patronage and hospitality, goods, and land. In other words, as the poets put it, in exchange for mere wealth, which is transitory, noble patrons got immortal fame. Something, as I point out to my students back at Notre Dame, that seems to have been proven true in the case of certain honorands about whom we know literally nothing but what there is in a surviving poem. These works acclaimed and advised elite patrons, that is, lords and sometimes their wives, across Gaelic and Gaelicized Ireland and Scotland, though they might also offer critique, voice gentle correction, or even threaten satire if the patron failed to maintain noble norms of comportment, particularly those entailing generous support and a high degree of respect for the literati who depended upon him. Yet alongside this overwhelmingly praise-focused professional poetic tradition, we find a relatively smaller but clearly popular store of learned love poetry. The Dents de Gras, or poems of love, mostly range from 3 to 10 quatrains. Unlike the more demanding and exclusive works of Don Zierach, these were composed in less exacting meters from the 14th to 17th centuries by both professional poets and aristocratic amateurs. Roughly 75% of these learned or aristocratic love poems survive as anonymous texts in 17th century manuscripts, a period when more amateurs were composing and a literate audience for poetry and its collection was emerging, with greater interest in recording their efforts, as well as a growing appreciation of the literary value of poetry qua poetry as a basis for collection. Influenced first by continental models and later by love poets of the English Renaissance, whose work they borrowed and even translated, native Irish poets thoroughly assimilated the themes of courtly love, as Micheál Macraw and others have shown. The Dents de Gras typically portray love as illness, toxin, or exquisite torture. The poems range from serious and agonized to playful, wittily ironic, or even impressively bawdy, with the spicier works excluded from O'Rahilly's decorous collection, presumably owing to some mixture of prudishness, dismissal of their literary value, or nationalist anxiety about violating the supposed refinement of other countries' literary traditions, which, of course, were themselves often Baudelaireized. Like their continental courtly love equivalents, the Dante Gras overwhelmingly express a male perspective on romance. As Grace Neville demonstrated in her series of important articles on the genre, they rehearse men's desire, rage, satisfaction, refusal, derision, certitude, regret, self-reassurance, and so forth, with women cast as beautiful yet inaccessible, fickle, or even cruel tormentors. Though there are exceptions to the rule, male poets typically dramatize their physical agony and psychological torment at the slender hands of curly-haired, crimson-mouthed, crystal-eyed women who often prove incomprehensibly indifferent to their poetic blandishments. This all stands in sharp contrast to the fulsome admiration bardic poets heaped on their male patrons across many hundreds of extant texts. For as we know, the much celebrated bromance between poet and patron was central to the bardic tradition. While there were frequent, much lamented fallings out between poets and patrons, as described by Paul Branagh, the relationship was idealized as one of much vaunted reciprocal regard. According to the poet, he and his patron were enduring friends and intimates, notwithstanding the transactional nature of their relationship, which the poet was at pains to mystify by emphasizing its and his authenticity, warmth, free choice, naturalness, and so forth, key tropes that we find in the work. A poet successfully launched on his professional career, served as a valued member of his patron's inner circle, or Iskra. Better still, provided the poet had qualified as olive or master, after some 7 years of training, he might ascend to become the official appointed Olive Flaha, or chief's poet, to his lordly patron, thus becoming a member of a small elite cadre and gaining still more status as the sign and source of his chief's prestige, in Branagh's words. The named Olive to a lord enjoyed considerable intimacy with his patron, whom he served as close advisor and right-hand man, with this precedence publicly displayed at feasts where he sat at the patron's elbow or shoulder, and in his day-to-day role as his particular far gras, man of trust, confidant, retainer, or favorite, sharing his lord's confidence and even his bed. Given the intimacy of this relationship, a common conceit in bardic patronly poetry is that which figures the poet as the patron's lover or spouse, Kayla or Lennon, and their relationship as a marriage, most commonly and elaborately, where the poet was an intimate of the patron or his appointed Olive Flaha, or hoped to be. Within bardic praise poetry, as Branagh remarks, quote, what amounts to a whole vocabulary of affection is used to couch the encomiastic praising addresses of poet to patron, so much so that often, in the words of James Carney, the resulting poem could pass for an expression of the deepest passion, close quote. Unlike many so-called love poems to women, in poems appealing to patrons, we find many synonyms for love to convey the intimate bond between poet and patron, with mourn employed to denote the particular favor or esteem shown to an Olive Flaha by his lord, and degrish, love, zeal, fervor, conveying much the same thing. Conversely, when such favor was lacking, it was catastrophic. As one poet said, turn of dochish di mornia, loss of favor is collapse of hope. To nurture the relationship, bardic poets proffered munificent praise to their patrons, as detailed by Eleanor Knott in her landmark edition of the work of MacAward's contemporary, Tadhg Dal O'Higgins, who lived in the second half of the 16th century. Patrons were genealogically fit. I'm going to zoom through this really, really quickly, but just to set it up for you. Patrons were genealogically fit, martially skilled, high-ranking, manly, discerning. Metaphorically, a bear, a hound, a lion, a salmon, a hawk, a mythical animal, a range of plants or parts thereof, or other natural phenomena, a spear, a shield, costly and rare things, their parts admired, their whole rendered exceptional. the sheer amount of admiration, if stylized and often insincere, that was lavished upon patrons by their poetic paramours can be mind-boggling. When you think about it, as I admit, few people, with the notable exceptions, you know, here, actually do. That which was recorded, of course, and that which survives is only a tiny fraction of what must have been performed over the centuries. To return to the love poetry, many of these works similarly feature high-flown praise for their objects, and often, like bardic praise poems, employ nature imagery invoking a wide range of animal and plant life to do so, as well as images of fire, water, and so forth. In that sense, we are in a recognizable poetic world, the world of praise. Greater exploration of the similarities and differences in these genres would be worthwhile, but is beyond the scope of today's lecture. But the passionate or once passionate relationship the learned love poems depict is often notably and explicitly antagonistic. That is, against the seemingly happy homosocial mutual admiration engine of patronly works, with their many, many words of warm affection, the lovers of the Dents de Grâce often appear to be opponents engaged in a power struggle. Neville stressed this point in her work, and it is particularly relevant for us today. For while sometimes the male poet is successful in capturing and taming the woman of his dreams, as I have already suggested, more frequently he claims to be frustrated by the object of his affections and thereby given a great deal to complain of in verse. In McAward's poem, a degree of tension manifests from the very first line, and now we're launching into the poem, so you can follow along on your handout. In the hectoring direct address by the male speaker to the projected female auditor, the poem stages itself as an address to a young woman who is unnamed, but evidently at least somewhat known to the speaker, as he knows what is and is not gnaw, usual, line two, for her. This is not exactly a conventional love poem, though. Note that that first negative word is more common in poems of grief. And rather than praising the lady, the poem begins with his reproof about how tiresome it is for her to be uncharacteristically duach, gloomy or melancholy. Tiresome, not for her, though, but for him. Characterizing her failure to be lively and attractive as wearisome arguably points up women's proper function as ornament, entertainment, and poetic love object for men. Indeed, it seemingly prompts this departure from a more admiring poetic proceeding. The change in her demeanor, line four, though we, your gloom or dejection or sadness, even shocks him. And ingnad in bardic poetry often conveys wonder in a negative sense. That is, her mien contrasts with her usual demeanor, but given the literary and imagined social occasion, perhaps also violates norms of polite decorum, occasioning his own subtle literary violation. In turn, there may also be an implication that she actually looks bad, if the very sight of her is tiresome. In any case, he begins and then continues throughout the poem to comment authoritatively on her appearance, as this genre does constantly, through a series of one-sided suppositions, closing out the stanza by addressing her again as woman, Avan, the vocative, at once generic and gendered, as if to reinforce his superior masculine judgment and right to speak. Surely, he goes on in stanza two, whatever has her heart sore, he doubts that any of her kin has died, line 6-7, and he cannot understand the reason for her dejection, 8, noche digem fa de vroin. The implication is that her negative emotions are extreme, inappropriate, and mystifying. Imagine him exclaiming, who died? So he chides her for them. As the poem continues, our speaker continues to make her mood his business and to judge her for it, authoritatively pronouncing his thoughts. By now, we may just be noticing that he prefers to impose his own interpretations upon his purported interlocutor rather than, for example, perhaps posing questions about what he loudly professes to find incongruous, surprising, and inexplicable. For though he says he doesn't know, he is engaged, in effect, in both sides of an elucidating exchange. He is, as another translator, the masterful Frank O'Connor has it, a man of experience, the knowing older man who can tell just what's going on and who can therefore advise and guide her toward a specific solution that he would be happy to provide. In stanza three, he describes the comportment of one he now praisefully addresses as a fairy princess, whose Osnalua and Lowert's Wall, quick sigh and slow speech, betrays some grief or heartache. It seems he tells her, Grimmi Nieginort, that something has befallen you, as is shown in her kr aspect or appearance, causing her looks to depart her ekshindo kr ernulniet, that is, you have lost your beauty. Indeed, in stanza four, he asserts, Dohim gerchlechlo aniv, I see a change or deterioration in its brightness, that is, her appearance's brightness, that it is, it has dimmed. He carries on with praise for her dimpled cheeks and thick curled hair in 14, her lively step and fair neck in 15, but this praise is ambiguous. It's not clear whether those are real-time compliments or a negative comparison of her current looks to her past beauty, intended like the carpe diem motif so common in other early modern seduction poems, to prod her to seize love while she still can. Instead, another pattern emerges in these opening stanzas. The authoritative older man asserts his dominance over the young woman, critiquing her appearance and then praising it, chiding her behavior and then complimenting her, offering a hot and cold mixture of critical and flattering attention that positions him as the arbiter of everything relating to this seemingly vulnerable young woman. In modern terms, we might call this a 400-year-old instance of negging, a form of emotional manipulation in which negative feedback or backhanded compliments are deployed in an attempt to undermine the confidence of the perceived high-status target so that she doubts her own senses and self-knowledge, and instead seeks reassurance or approval from the pickup artist. And I have a footnote to the precise set of ridiculous texts that this is drawn from. At any rate, here I should remark that invoking the surprisingly similar techniques of today's seduction artists is intended not only to amuse you, but to enlighten all of us. I began evoking the parallel, I have to say, in class some years ago, to help American undergraduates, recognize the familiar in what they were looking at, in something so distant in place, time, and language, and thus to feel empowered to speak in class and to have an actual discussion about the text. But it can help all of us bring the poem's rhetorical moves into focus. And this is not merely complaint, commiseration, or compliment in this text, but something more, something whose mechanisms deserve scrutiny. Returning to the poem, having proceeded thus far without a diagnosis, now at the end of quatrain four, the speaker at last suggests the reason for the lady's dimmed radiance. Kussel godugish gra dear, it's likely you've given love to a man. All is revealed, that's line 16, all is revealed, and her mopey face and constant sighs are at last rendered comprehensible. Of course the young woman is in love with a man, the only acceptable explanation for her failure to be fully present and properly ornamental to the man who addresses her. The speaker does not, however, stop there. A further clue that he doesn't seek merely to solve the mystery, but to turn it to his profit. Moving from deductive description to confident speculation to insistent demands, in stanza five, the speaker orders her, whatever man on earth it is, na kelorum, don't hide it from me. Addressing the young woman more intimately in an embodied endearment as the flowing locks, 18, for which she was praised in the previous stanza. Next, he directs her, 19, na fulang nis fudze ebane. Love that line. Don't suffer any longer in pain. Here I note that our translator has playfully inverted the literal meaning of the line in anticipation of the attempted seduction to come. So presumably the implication of line 19 is don't suffer silently any longer, don't hide your lovesickness, but gain the relief of speaking it aloud, something like that. Indeed, the speaker reassures her at stanza's end she could tell him even Rama Misha Fain on far, even if I myself were the man. centering all his speculation on himself and moving from line 16's, "You love a man," to "If I were the man." Mm-hmm. He signals his joking hypothetical by employing the suppositional conjunction "thou" here, the one used for the conditional irreal instead of the real, that is, the unattainable, fanciful, or doubtful case versus the attainable, likely, and possible one on Klassel Knielach, Iata, Shachas on Klassel Knielach, Oskelte. It's merely a joke, denied even as it's posed, though voiced as a possibility, however unlikely, all the same. Having floated this comic suggestion, following those domineering imperatives, having made a sort of deniable test run, the speaker elaborates in stanza 6 upon just how sympathetic he would be. How sympathetic? So sympathetic. So sympathetic that he would, altruistically really, give her permission to pursue him. Because he's just that kind of stand-up guy. By implication, he is the desirable love object who would be friendly to her if she were to chase him. Just her luck. He's not just a man on the make, though this sort of reverse construction is in fact a standard tool in the toolbox of the modern pickup artist, I discovered. At any rate, once she unburdens herself to him about her lovesickness, who's to say such intimacy might not effect a transfer of those possibly entirely hypothetical affections? Having in line 21 projected his desires onto her, "Kad shurga do yefa wem," permission to woo you would obtain from me, he addresses her with a still more intimate corporeal vocative, "O slender mouth, the color of berries," that confirms his sexual appetite with the well-known metaphor conflating eating and sex and associating women's body parts with fruits, while reducing her to a synecdoche as all or only mouth or red target of desire. Ironically, the part that consumes and that stands in for more intimate engulfment, when he is the would-be consumer and the nonstop talker, too. Next, he reiterates his commiseration with her supposed feelings, figuring himself as truly grasping her emotions, while posing a vision of how kind he would be in line 23, saying, "Do hikin dove ibain," I would understand your being in pain. Presumably unlike most men, unlike the beloved who leaves her suffering, since line 24, "the vimishahain idhra," I myself have been in your state. The pickup artist attempts to build trust and intimacy through mirroring and self-disclosure, "I know what you're going through, I've been there," while promoting himself as mature and sensitive. Things progress rapidly in stanza 7 with the verbal equivalent of what the dating manipulation world would call an escalation. The speaker shifts from the conditional speculation of the previous stanza to the past tense, referring in line 25 on "gra buishin tugishtam," this foolish love you gave to me, as if the stanza break has somehow magically effectuated his fantasies. Here the speaker projects his desire onto her while concretizing and specifying it with the demonstrative pronoun and the adjective angrabuishin, this foolish love. Now, the syntax of the first couplet conceivably confers an implied conditional. But "if I knew you loved me" is ambiguous, such that there might or might not in fact be love, while the stanza's structure plays with that by placing line 25 stanza initial, thus presenting and leaving momentarily suspended that more certain tense before the arrival of the conditional conjunction at the front of the following line. This is followed by yet another intimately corporeal vocative addressed to her fine hand, her smooth palm or hand, that seeks to knit them together. Moreover, by shifting the subordinating thaw clause away from the woman's desire to the speaker's own knowledge and actions, and taking hers as given, he once more advances his aims by engineering a more favorable construction. That is, the conditional no longer refers to the hypothetical of her loving him, but just to what he would do if he knew. That is, he declares, "Samrudshin ni leikintu," I would not leave you in misery. By the end of the stanza, when he says, "Truanar legish dorunrin," alas that you did not admit your secret to me, he has worked to ensure that the supposed secret is all but certain, at least in his telling. Stanza 8 goes on to take the supposition of stanza 7 that she gave him love, but but to seemingly retard it by saying, if, ma ta gudugish gradam, if you have given love to me. But now McAward employs the more certain of the forms of the conditional conjunction, ma, the more likely, the more real, and klasel kunilacht oskolte, accompanied by the present substantive. So he can further propel his hoped-for framing. In turn, he moves from, if I knew you loved me, to if you did love me, using a more certain conjunction, before going on to stress how receptive and non-judgmental he would be in lines 30 to 31. Ironically, paralleling a contemporary pickup artist's self-description technique intended to cause the target to be more likely to disclose and then to repeat prior sexual acts because of reduced fear of shaming. Concerns about shaming and gossip seem to have been common enough at the time, judging by anonymous dents de gras of the period composed in women's voices and possibly, in fact, authored by women. In several of these, the speaker refers to what people will say, either as a reason to cease communications, as in the case of a Humpain Shachanshinya, avoid me, my dear, or to spur public commitment, as in a Humpain Kwivni Mesha, dear friend, remember me, as well as Deinem van Monia so said, let us go to the grove to our east. These texts, one of which is included on your handout because I'll be referring to it again, these texts confirm that women's preoccupation with or canny deployment of negative judgments of their romantic lives, gossip and hearsay and so on, though the Celtic tradition also, of course, has fabulous examples of sublime indifference to such small-mindedness, such as Guervo Mechain's 15th century poem to her vulva, or her contemporary Isabel Nivek-Kalein, flourishing 1500, with her own forthright work. Returning to stanza 8 of our poem, the speaker concludes by once more stressing his sympathetic understanding and his mature experience of such things. Ahnacham marvi sangra, I am well acquainted with how love is or does be. Having warmed his quarry with sympathy and a knowing phrase, in stanza 9, the speaker escalates things yet again. Recurring to the pickup artist's tactic of positioning the woman as pursuer, he addresses her in the imperative, ka ora ma erla fir, fix your choice on me, O wavy hair. In an interesting sort of crux, he orders her to choose him as if she just needs a little encouragement to speak up, his imperative attempting to elicit her authoritative choosing by once more making himself the supposed object of desire. Next, he suggests that she will happily get everything she wants, but lat gach ni imia dochit, in wooing him to her fair breast, movrega redvunya wan. In this construction, she has the opportunity to entice him to her bosom, not vice versa, in a comic reversal of conventional gender roles. As Grace Neville remarks, he sees himself as the first prize, as every woman's desire. And when, at stanza's end, he asks suggestively, kafis nachwilinanritz, who knows what is in store for you, or literally, who knows what is not in store for you, 36, he at once dangles the exciting yet intriguingly unspecified future he is trying to get her to buy into, and tacitly admits its fantastical quality, for who knows, kind of admits its own speculative quality, and all the words in the world cannot guarantee the carnal knowing that he has been trying to effectuate the transformation of discourse into intercourse. Stanza 10 assures the young woman once more that her entreaty will be warmly met, telling her bluntly, be the maslach, achrufio, come on, tempt me, O modest form, saying, who knows when it will be her lucky day, when she will fulfill wem dovien, your desire from me, yet again asserting her desire for him. Stanza 11 makes a final emphatic pitch full of imperatives aiming to seal the deal after urging her, ni bjögrits erlegish hort, enough of what has passed, 41. Returning to the precept that the pickup artist should persuade his quarry that he represents a safe opportunity to rewrite any sexual mistakes, the speaker directs his addressee to forget shame and instead suggestively nocht do rune, bear your secret or heart and presumably bear other things. Imaginatively moving in for the kill, he commands her to dzridanal, come closer, and corrects her, na be marson, don't be like that. And finally closes the poem poem, not with an embrace or expressions of love, but rather with a final telling directive. Feachan krusan the will to. Look at the state you're in. Thus the poem ends with a final assertion of his quarry's abject condition. He treats her state as the final uncontestable basis for the transactional obligation he's been setting up throughout the poem. You're worth nothing. I'm fabulous. You owe it to yourself to have sex with me because you want to. You'll never get this chance again. It's the ultimate hard sell. So the poet affects a duna, or closing, by recurring to the hectoring negging of the opening with the most minimal of syllabic near repetitions to provide technical closure. But perhaps it's so minimal, that is, the closure is so minimal, because there really isn't, in fact, closure. There isn't closure or clarity in the ending. For this closing command to look at herself, the assertion of her absolute shambles in the sense that words fail evokes a performance of the unspeakable, but equally encodes a tacit admission of the possible failure of words and thus of seduction itself. Has he succeeded in making her admit she loves him, or making her transfer her affections or have affections at all? The secret that perhaps did not even originally exist? Or if, as he says in the penultimate line, she shouldn't be like that at this late stage, does that mean she is, in fact, still like that, the way she was at the start, unmoved by his whole dramatic performance and still not in a crux or shape to be loved at all? Has his masterclass in poetic manipulation nonetheless fallen short, deflated like his hopes? Or is she relenting, coming close and being soothed by the knowing man who has told her what she is and how to feel? Having come this far, let us attempt to adjudicate before closing by briefly examining two other love poems to help bring McAwards into focus. Another poem of would-be seduction, also given on the handout, is one of a handful of love poems mentioned previously that might have been composed by women in the early modern period. Denim von Monso said, "Let us go to the grove to our east," edited by Maureen Iranuchu, also offers a suggestive address to a love object. But here, instead of alternating reproaches and compliments and a set of speculations that insistently ratchet up, the speaker enthusiastically urges the beloved to join her. This poem reads much more like an enthusiastic invitation to a reluctant but promising love object than a trick or trap. She entices her love object by picturing a liminal, sylvan retreat full of mutual gustatory delights, proposing ihimsuva darmosiv, let us eat wild strawberries from our palms, the fruit evoking the carnal pleasure she hopes he will want. Addressing him as avaka vachara yil, a young man of the bright laugh, she reverses the roles in McAward's poem and encourages him to kardanoid afuid dachasiv, overcome your shyness, literally put your shame beneath your feet, like stamp it out. Further locating her as the forward sensual one in the world of abstract knowledge, evoked by her male target as a student and the hazel grove above. Instead of fearing exposure, she hopes that rumors of their liaison will come true and concludes lustily, togort fast thagis denev, arise, let us proceed, neatly circling back to her opening, once more with even more feeling. How different this enthusiastic poem is from McAward's unrelenting machinations. Different, too, is the other surviving love poem by the same poet, which I have included as well. In sharp contrast with Tershachshin, though Verum shall receive nos, I shall devote a while to folly, does not even directly address the beloved, one Grania. Instead, the poet embraces Sivnos, folly, signifying his grand infatuation, but surely also his dalliance with the genre, with love poetry itself, in place of more serious work. Indeed, his spell composing this poem itself. There is no direct seduction at all here. If anything, he praises and teases from afar, while surely amusing his confrère. The poet makes a series of witty, at times salacious declarations punning on the woman's name, which means both ugliness and grain, as in a grain or germ of wheat. You all can have your beautiful woman. Ishien van div begranya basai velam imdaba. It is the woman among them who would be the most granya, ugly, I would most happily have in my bed. Like, you can have them all. I just want granya. Okay. So of all the women of Scotland and England even, the barlam begun parta on ri is grania da waka. I would rather a little affection from the most grania, ugly, woman I've ever seen. And to be without oats or wheat, ugh, small matter, but to be without grania, grain, ugh, tragedy. And mavalach mar parta, narag of grania im ichlan, my curse on my associate or my wingman who did not leave grania in my granary. Most grania of women, he concludes, tugshi muhil echlechlo. She has caused my wit to fail. And notice there are a couple of words here that we also have in our first poem, but used very differently. Hence, shall receive nostoverum. So, you know, I've lost it. I'm crazy about her. I've just been driven mad. So a while I'll spend in folly. Note how we've playfully inverted the first line so that we have a kind of, you know, twisted duna. We recur to it, but we flipped it almost as a sign of how, like, topsy-turvy he is, you know, I'd like to think. So the speaker's desire is manifest. His submission is clear. Although he's not shy about making sexual jokes to appeal to a broader audience, or indeed to the woman herself, surely referenced by the granary or threshing floor where the grain is pounded, ba-dum-bumps. Probably also by the tasty germ or grain that he wants in his bed and cannot do without. Not so far from those oral or genital strawberries, and possibly even evoking a clitoral reference. I warned them that there would be some stuff in here that has never occurred in a Tudor Stuart Ireland plenary, at any rate. So as we see in other love poetry of the era. All right. So humble is not quite the word for this poem, but this is not the braggadocio of our main poem either. So contrasting these poems, very different playfulness with McAward's seduction poem highlights the centrality of the speaker's brash performance itself, I would say. In our walk through the poem or gallop through the poem, we largely suspended disbelief to attend to the text as a seduction, as a sort of witty demonstration, not unlike all those found on pickup artist websites that promise to turn unsuccessful Lotharios into the emotionally bankrupt alpha males of their dreams. In such a reading, the text functions as a lesson or script by one man for others. Watch and learn, lads. If we read it this way, the poem seems like a sort of a less violent version, but indeed, I just need a drum kit here, a less violent version of the obscene pedagogy discussed by Carissa Harris in her book, in which men teach other fellows how to seduce or to rape and compete and boast about their conquests, making women's subordination and abuse central to male bonding. In such a reading, our speaker's verbal entrapment of the woman is part of the joke, and sharing his attempted intimate scene with her is something for other men's delectation. Yet the poem is not, of course, and cannot be an actual seduction. We have no proof of this woman's love or even of her existence. The poem is a one-sided monologue, as much play as poem, perhaps conveying less how to seduce than how to produce, how to craft courtly verse and accompanying male persona and the accompanying male persona that is part of the performance of early modern civility and manliness, and that was indeed part of the deep play for manly status in much earlier instances of courtly love on the continent. Such poems, even when addressed to female poetic objects who may or may not be present or even extant, ultimately appear less invested in appealing to women than to fellow men. Think of the exchange around Breed na Geralt, where she is not an actual target for adultery, but the occasion for a witty exchange between and among male patrons and their poets, in which she unusually actually takes part. Such poems are often part of ongoing exchanges between and among men, thus disclosing further instances of the homosocial bonding that early modern Irish poetry constantly mediates. Crucially, however, unlike many of the obscene texts Carissa Harris describes, in this poem the woman does not ultimately say yes, nor does she say no and get violated anyway, as in all too many medieval pastorales. Instead, we cannot be sure how it ends, and it is just as legible as an unsuccessful campaign as a victory. If this is so, and if it is not so easily legible as a triumph of poetic seduction or as a model for it, maybe that's because it's actually doing something else, offering us an alternative, more expansive and funnier reading with which I close. In keeping with the well-known propensity for irony associated with the genre, instead of reading this poem straight, we might ultimately see it as a commentary on the creaky mechanisms of the genre itself. If this poem seems all male bombast and far too little female response, that little, in fact, entirely projected, as in so many poems, perhaps this is so precisely because it is meant to be read as preposterous, as to some extent a parody of courtly love's absurdly androcentric, deluded maneuvers, less seduction lesson or genuine poetic exemplar than rhetorical display carried to hilarious extremes. Its misogyny and self-importance corrected and critiqued by laughter for the amusement of all, including, theoretically, potential female audiences. The poem's own excesses and inversions promote this reading, but we have a couple of further clues. Line 36 referenced the future with a word that also means poem, dawn, saying, "Who knows what is not in store for you," as if this may in fact not be in store, potentially puncturing the speaker's bubble, but also potentially signifying who knows what is not in a poem for you. That is, who knows where you may find yourself placed if you are a woman in a dawn gras. And the poem's final exclamation also yields another meaning. When he says, "Feach an krussan a will to," look at the state you're in, kruh, or state, is also another term for form, so that he draws attention again, precisely at the poem's end, to its artifice and poetic nature. Look at that form you're in, that is, look at the poem and the rhetoric in which we attempt to entrap you, and is as if also speaking to himself and other men, male poets in that moment, the poet suggests finally that all they have is their ridiculous words, ultimately with a proto-feminist flourish, undoing the genre and turning the joke on himself. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this Tudor and Stuart Ireland Conference podcast. The annual Tudor and Stuart Ireland Interdisciplinary Conference takes place in a venue in Ireland in August every year. For more information on attending, go to tudorstuartireland.com. There is now an extensive archive of around 300 podcasts from previous Tudor and Stuart Ireland conferences freely available to listen to. To access this archive, go to historyhub.ie or search for Tudor and Stuart Ireland on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or on Spotify.